We're looking at young women who justified sexual impurity. Our lesson is taken from Genesis chapter 19. So let's turn over to Genesis chapter 19. The first 11 verses of chapter 19 describe the climate of Sodom, what kind of city it was. And then in chapter 18, verse 20 through 23, there's some additional description of Sodom. In chapter 18, beginning there, God said Sodom was sinful, but he said more. What was the Lord's description? Exceedingly great. All cities have sin. But it says that the Lord said, this is not even some human opinion. The Lord said their sin is exceedingly grave, verse 20. If we're interested in what God thinks about us, that's a very telling phrase. Notice over, hold your finger here and go to Jude. Go to the book of Jude. We have a reference to Sodom in the New Testament. In verse 7, now I'm reading from the New American Standard Version. First, let me back up to verse 4. There were men turning the grace of God into, this version says, licentiousness. Your version may have a different word there, into licentiousness. In other words, they were saying God's grace makes that okay. In verse 7, Sodom and Gomorrah are referenced. Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities around them, since they in the same way as these, indulged in gross immorality. Your version may say that they gave themselves over to sexual immorality. In other words, there was no normal barriers to the way people use their bodies. And interestingly, here in Jude, he said that there are those creeping in among the saints who are striving to say it's okay. The grace of God says it's okay. Today, there are churches. We're talking on Sunday morning about why can I not attend that church? There are churches today in the Houston area that say the kind of things that went on at Sodom and Gomorrah are okay. That God is such a loving God and a God full of grace that He doesn't look down upon that conduct. But what I'm reading is that's a danger to saints to think that way in Jude. So here we're way back in Genesis, and here we are in Jude. And so we've moved down the stream of time, what, a couple thousand years. And now we're 2,000 years removed from Jude. And you have the same problem in our area today. So the Bible is an old book, but a very current book dealing with the problems people face today. Turn over to Romans chapter 1. Once you get your finger there, I want to go back and note something in Genesis, but go ahead and turn to Romans chapter 1. So we're talking about what Sodom is known for. And Jude puts his finger on it in Jude verse 7. In Genesis 19, there's a further description of what this grave sin is. And you can read this and you'll see that the people there, the men there, preferred homosexual relationships over heterosexual relationships. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 4. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old. Note, it goes throughout the age range of the people in Sodom. The whole society was corrupt. You remember Abraham had prayed for the sparing of the city, but there wasn't even enough righteous people to spare the city. All the people from every quarter, they called to Lot and said to them, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." Or your verb may say, "know them," which was the Hebrew word for that. But Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him and said, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men as much as they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand aside." So they preferred this perverted, unnatural relationship to the natural relationship that God ordained. Look at Romans chapter 1. This sin of depravity is not like you go to the store and go to eat a hamburger and you get a ketchup packet. It's by kind of by itself. And oftentimes sin is viewed that way. It's just this one sin, but it doesn't work that way. It permeates and it spreads into further and further depravity. And that's what happens when this sin is tolerated. Look at Romans chapter 1. In verse 26, it says, God gave them over to degrading passions. Note, by the way, the first thing they did is to renounce God as their creator, creator and the right to direct their lives, verse 25. And when men put God out, these kind of activities are okay in their minds. But verse 26, he gave them over to degrading passions. For the women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. In the same way also the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men committing indecent acts and receiving of their own persons the due penalty of their error. But people who practice that have already rejected God as the pattern of their moral life. So look at verse 28. Just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, being filled with unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, envy, murder, strife, etc. These men were not only perverted in their sexual desires. You can see they had no regard for other people's possessions. They'd have broken the door down if they could have. Had no regard for other people's wishes and desires or other people's family. It was all very selfish. Here's what we want. We don't care if you're hurt, whether you agree or don't agree. And so it's not just this one sin. It goes with a package of things. Once you renounce God as the standard of your life, what's to stop you doing anything? Murder if necessary. And I wouldn't be surprised they would have done that with Lot had they been able to. But you remember he was protected by angels. But nevertheless, that's an important lesson to us about this grave sin. Now, when you look at Genesis 19 and 8, I just want to do a passing notice of one thing that troubles people. We're not going to spend much time on it. In verse 8, Lot makes this offer. He said, "I have two daughters who have not had relations with man." First, that's a notable thing. These girls were of marriageable age. In fact, they were betrothed to some men. But it says they were virgins. I don't know if this is a credit to Lot's training. They grew up in a city where young and old from every quarter was so very wicked. But here are two ladies, old enough to get married, two young women, but they were virgins. I find that very interesting. What influenced them to be virgins and not just throw morality completely aside? Was it Lot? We know that the Bible says, whatever you say about this verse, Peter says Lot was a righteous man, a godly man. Furthermore, we know he had the courage. He was a man of courage. He had the courage to stand at the door and block these men at the risk of his own life. So he was a man of courage with faith, and he believed in God. But the question arises, how in the world can a man offer his daughters, knowing what these men would do to them, in lieu of these strangers who had come to be hospitable to him? Now, I'll tell you right off the top, I don't know the answer. There's a lot of suggestions that have been made. I can see some things that may have a part. I don't know. You know, today, you offered a man a case of beer for a piece of cake that he had. He has this piece of cake he'd like to have. He said, "Here, I'll give you a case of beer." What would most men do today? They'd take that beer. Man, that's $20 worth of beer, whatever it costs. I'll take the beer. But you know, if I had a piece of cake you wanted and you offered me 10 cases of beer, if you offered me a truckload of beer, I'd say, "Keep your beer. I don't want it." Maybe Lot knew that they were those kind of men. They didn't want the women. Maybe instead of a weakness in Lot's morality, he had a cunning plan in play. I don't know if that's the case. Does that answer it? Definitely. Certainly doesn't. The simplest view is simply that Lot, this is a blot on his character. Good men sin. We read about Abraham lying about his wife. We read about Peter acting the part of a coward in Galatians 2. We read about all the apostles deserting Christ in his hour of need. Good men fail at times. Maybe that's simply the answer. I don't know. But whatever it is in your judgment of Lot, just remember he's got two virgin daughters in a wicked city. We read in the New Testament he was a righteous man and a godly man, and he was a courageous man. You know, when we judge people, we need to look at the whole picture. Sometimes there are things people do I don't understand. But maybe I don't understand because I don't know the whole picture. I don't know. Does it justify what Lot did? We're not saying it justifies it at all. I'll tell you another thing it does, just the fact that this is in the divine record. Who wrote this? Moses wrote it. And you think about Moses writing this story about this righteous man. Same thing about Abraham. He told about his weaknesses. Told about Sarah laughing when she was told she'd have a child. And so, it's just an indication that what you're reading is a reliable historical account of what happened. Just like when we were studying about Christ and what was written about him and those who witnessed to him. You had a comment in this. Maybe he was. That's what I said. Maybe he was. Maybe this was a plan. He knew that they wouldn't want those women. But you're right. I said it just looked like he was willing to forfeit that and throw all of that away for the protection of his guest. Some have said, well, he knew they were angels. There's nothing in the text says he does. And if he did, why would he worry about that? They could take care of themselves. So I don't know the reason. I'm just making some comments that tell us that hopefully be careful about the conclusions we reach about Lot. situation. Well, you know more than I do, but that may be. I don't know that. That may be. That may be. I don't know. All right. So anyway, I just wanted to touch on that briefly as we get through that. So we've already answered question number two. What was the moral status of Lot's two daughters early in the story? They were virgins, which makes the rest of this story even more unusual and strange. Here they are in a wicked city of marriageable age, but they're virgins at this particular point. If these girls are virgins, and we know what happened in this story, what is it when you read the story that allowed a righteous, godly man to be a participant in this grossly evil deed? All right, look at verse chapter 19. Verse 32 and 33. Let us make our father drink wine. Verse 33, they made their father drink wine. Did they hold his nose and put a funnel, pour it down him? Do you think that's what that means? Oftentimes a person is said to do something when they're the cause behind the thing being done. I don't know enough about the story to know what went on. Did Lot not know that this was a powerful wine that would intoxicate him? I don't know. It would look like after he drank a glass or two, either by the taste or it had began to make him feel, he would tell his daughters, that's it. I don't want any more of that. I don't know. But in any case, they did something to persuade him to drink this wine and made him drunk. And here you have this good, righteous man. And here is a terrible blot on his story. And what do you credit to? Alcoholic beverage. When you see the commercials on TV, when you young people see the commercials on TV, you know, it's young people, they're smiling, they all seem like great health, it's beautiful, they're out on the beach, they're out cooking something in the backyard, drinking beer. You don't see this kind of story. You don't see the man that got drunk and beat up his wife, or went and had an affair with someone, or misused his child. You don't see that. That's what happened to Lot. You remember another fellow that happened to?
Noah.
Righteous man. He and his family, the only righteous people on the earth. Imagine that. What kind of man must Noah have been? Not just the city of Sodom, but the entire earth. He and his family. But Noah got drunk and committed a shameful act. Yeah, that alcohol is really good, isn't it? Really leads to good things, doesn't it? And so besides the lessons we learn from these two girls, these two young women, we see some other lessons here that can be valuable to us about the effect of something. And in the book of Proverbs, it warns you about that very thing, that you take a sip, you want more, then you want more, then you're irrational, and then it leads you to do irrational things. If Lot would have been in his right mind, I have no doubt that he would have had no participation at all with this. But intoxication, whether it's wine or beer or whiskey or drugs, takes your ability to think away, the ability to think clearly. There's a word in the New Testament that talks about our need to think clearly. It's a character trait we're to put on. Do you know what word I'm talking about?
Sober-mindedness.
That's right, being sober-minded. So So how many can you take and begin to lose sober-mindedness? One beer? Two beers? How many? And once you cross the threshold, will you stop? So nevertheless, these two girls knew the power of it, evidently. And so they used it for their purposes. And people will do that. They'll use intoxicating beverages for their purposes. Yes, Ennis? They may have. I have no idea. I do not know how they did it. All I know is they made him drink wine. That's very possible. I just don't know.
Graham,
yes.
One of the things here that it's interesting, it says that she did not know when she lay down nor when she rose. But for both girls, it's one thing about alcohol. People say, well, I can stop anytime. I can control my liquor. I control myself when I'm drinking. He didn't know. And you get to a point where you're drinking and you don't know what you've done. You wake up the next morning, you can't remember. And you've got to be careful with that because in situations like this, he didn't know what he was doing.
Right.
He knows when she lay down, when she woke up. We would, there are people today blackout drinking. And you don't know if you killed somebody, hurt somebody, done something to yourself. And it just takes that one moment, for decision making. And people are like, well, I can handle it. You didn't even know. You were completely out of it. You forgot about it. And the next morning, you're doing the ramifications of it.
That's a good point. When you're given anesthesia, drugs, you wake up and say, the doctor cut me here, and then he did this, and I know what he did, and I remember touching this. You remember any of that? No. Same thing with alcohol, except it's immoral practices oftentimes. So it's a good point that Keith makes.
Drugs that are out there now that they can slip you and you don't know what's going on.
Well, that's true. That's a good point. But there's no reason that I know of that he would have any reason to fear his two daughters. They were virgins. There's nothing about them being loose morally. Todd?
I don't think they went in the cave, went to the cave next door and picked up some liquor at the liquor store, So the girls had a plan to expect. They had the grapes growing, they made the wine, the plan took some time. So maybe to Lennon's point, they had a plan put together here, maybe. We can only speculate.
Yeah, we don't know. That's just a lot we don't know about this. And my next question here, along with that very point, we ask you the question, after Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, where did Lot and his daughter stay? In the mountains, in a nice house they had built up there, a cottage. In a cave in the mountains. And you read earlier in this text, verse 27, in the morning, after God had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, verse 28, and toward all the land of the valley, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. So here they are, they fled from their home, from their house, from their city. They run up into the mountains, and they're in a cave. Maybe the next morning they could come out and look down. That's where I used to live. There's not a soul alive. There's not a house standing. It's complete decimation. Not just the city, but the valley. Imagine the impact that would have. That's somewhat the setting now that you get into when you read about their plan that Todd is talking about in verse 31. So, when they look down at that, question number 5, what was their justification for what they engaged in? Say what?
Lineage preservation.
Okay, lineage preservation. Well, couldn't they just go find them another husband?
It starts out with they thought.
They thought what?
There was no man to marry.
There's nobody left. Look down there. There's nobody. Our city's gone. The whole thing's gone. And so they drew this conclusion. They said, there's not a man on earth to come into us. And as Sandra's well pointed out, in other words, to continue our heritage, to continue humankind on this earth. So here's the situation. It's not a situation they caused. There's no indication they were immoral like Sodom. And besides that, it's a situation in their view that has potential terrible results. Is this the end of humanity? At least the end of my daddy's name? I don't know how much they knew about the promises to Abraham. Is this the end of the idea of Hebrews? I don't know. And so they proposed a solution that seemed to have a worthy end. That is, to produce seed. Isn't that great? Isn't that good? It has a worthy end. And when people see a situation that may have terrible results, but in their mind they think, I know I shouldn't do this, but good can come out of it. And the good overweighs the fact that it's wrong. What do you call that?
Situation
ethics. That's exactly right. So here it is. Situation ethics. It's a story about it right here. Not the only one, but it's one of them. Right here in your Bible. Now, in verse 37 and 38, the result, of course, was each one conceived and bore a son. And one was named Moab and one was named Ammon. You know, back when Sarah wondered if God was going to keep his promise to Abraham that between the two of them they would have a son, what did she suggest to Abraham that he do?
Go to Hagar.
Go to Hagar. So she had a son by Hagar. Who was that?
Ishmael.
The history of Israel after that with the Ishmaelites, what was it like? Terrible. Warfare, conflict. That's right. The history of Israel with the Moabites and Ammonites, what was it like? They were some of their worst enemies. Why didn't God stop it? God doesn't work that way. He could have. He could have made us like the honeybee. You just go and seek the things that make the honey and you don't have any choices. But he don't make us that way. And we are free to choose. But also, we suffer the consequences of our choices. And we may suffer those consequences, not today and tomorrow, but next week and next year and next decade. And young people who are in this audience, you think about this as you grow older and you get old enough to make decisions. You make decisions for today. Who you date, what you do on a date, what you drink, what you eat. It's your decision. God lets you do it. But what about next year and 10 years from now? When you fall in love and you want to marry, well, I love them so much. Okay, but if you make this decision, what happens down the road. And so God let them go ahead, and they conceived and bore these boys. And it's at the stage for what? The enmity and strife that you read about between these two nations and the nation of Israel. That's right. And we're going to talk about that now as we talk about situation ethics. I've got a definition of situation ethics. You can find many. The fellow that really popularized it, I think this may be his, but it's at least it's similar. Let me read it to you. Quote, situation ethics, also called situational ethics, and ethics and theology. The position that moral decision making is contextual or dependent on a set of circumstances. Situation ethics holds that moral judgments must be made within the context of the entirety of the situation, and that all normative features of a situation must be viewed as a whole. The guiding framework for moral decision making is stated variously as that of acting in the most loving way to maximize harmony and reduce discord, or to enrich human existence, unquote. That's from the Britannica. You can find other definitions in other places, but that captures the idea. So let's look at situation ethics, and Ennis has already touched on my first point. They said you act in the most loving way. What is the first and foremost love required of man?
Love of God.
Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And Jesus said this is the first and foremost or greatest commandment. So you may love someone, you may love yourself, but first and foremost, what's the will of God? That's the greatest love of all. Now, over in Matthew 10:34, when Jesus was commissioning his apostles to go preach the gospel and told them that they would be persecuted, this love of God that you've got to have supersedes all other loves. And one of those loves that we hold maybe right after God is so dear, sometime before God, is love of family. But Jesus said in Matthew 10:34, do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. I came to set a man against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies would be the members of his household. Listen to this. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. But if I do this, I'll lose my wife. I'll lose my husband. Maybe somebody's convinced they're in adultery. I can't. This poor woman's dependent on me. We've been married 10 years. What about the children we have? The loving thing to do is to keep on living like we're living. Or is it? If her soul's in jeopardy because of it, and if the children's soul will be in jeopardy as they see your attitude, is it the loving thing to do? It may be the loving emotional thing to do. And it may be that person does have some high regards in their care for the person. But first and foremost, Jesus said, you got to love me. And if it divides family by teaching the gospel, Jesus told these men, so be it. So I'd love to obey you, Peter. You're teaching the gospel here to my family. But if I do, my husband says he'll leave me. I can't have my husband leave me. I've got children. Now, what's the best thing for me to do? So first it's a question of priorities, and the second one we're touching upon, and that is subjective. Instead of God's standard of right and wrong, what's right and wrong is within my judgment. For example, here's Job. He was healthy, wealthy, wise, respected. He lost his health. He lost his possessions. He lost the respect of his wife. He lost the respect of the community. If you love yourself, is that a responsibility to love yourself? What would have been the loving thing to do? How about euthanasia? Why not? I mean, wouldn't that be love? Get him out of his misery? But never, ever did Job contemplate that. He kept asking, why? And interesting, God never told him. What about his three friends? Don't they love Job? They see him suffering. Why don't they put him to death? Not out of hatred, out of love. Put him out of his misery. You say, well, I don't think that's right, but I think it's right. So who's right? It becomes subjective. And whether it's done or not, it's whoever's got the power. Might makes right. And that's a problem with situation ethics. There was an article in Reader's Digest many years ago about what could happen if people abandon God in a country. You get to be 55, you go before a board. They examine you, your thinking, your abilities. If you're not contributing to society and you're just a tax burden, you know what the best thing to do for society is? Get rid of you. See, nobody would advocate that. Folks, there's people in this country advocate that right now. And they do it with babies. What's wrong with it? It's a situation that has potentially terrible consequences. It has a worthy end to justify it. Save people taxes. Relieve people from the difficulty of caring for their loved ones. Why not? Because of where we started. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Your neighbor as yourself. That's why. There's a story. Whether it's true or not, I'm not sure. It may be. It's an old, old story. It came out in connection with the situation ethics movement. There was a woman separated from her family at the Battle of the Bulge and imprisoned in the Ukraine. During those months, she learned that her husband, also a prisoner of war, had been released from another camp and had located all the children in Berlin. There were two reasons the Russians would release a prisoner: the need for extensive medical treatment or pregnancy. She persuaded a German guard to impregnate her and was returned to Germany as a liability. The family was reknit, and they all loved her and the child for it. Right or wrong? Situation, ethics. Furthermore, besides this point of the priority in our decision, which is God, and the subjective nature of it, which makes it very fluid, there are just so many scriptures that militate against the idea of situation ethics. I've got enough here to preach another sermon, but we're about out of time, so I won't.
Steve?
Yes, sir.
You mentioned about the abortion. Of course, abortion has been going on for thousands of years, and all sorts of euthanasia in various places in the world, almost in every corner of the world, they practice it to some degree, whether it's killing a newborn baby girl because they couldn't contribute, like a boy would later on.
There's pretty good evidence that they're doing organ harvesting in China right now. Taking organs from live people for other people. What's wrong with it? And so, anyway, there's a number of other arguments that are made to try to justify it, but we don't have time. I'm going to close with Job 2:4. Look at Job 2:4. Look, there's a lot of things never going to make me do wrong. But what if my life's on the line? I can't serve my family if they take my life. I can't talk to people about God if they take my life. The idea that a man will give up everything for his life, Job 2:4, is whose doctrine? Who said it?
Satan.
That's Satan's doctrine. Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he'll give for his life. That's Satan's doctrine. The Bible's full of examples. We've already studied some. Remember those college kids we were studying about? Told the king, you do whatever you want. I'm not going to worship your idol. And the Bible's full of those kind of examples to encourage us to righteous living. Thank you for your good attention tonight.